I should. I will, in a moment, call the House to order and do all of the things that I do as part of the debating process. But I wanted to just to say something about the context and the reason why I came last time, which was the first time I'd come to the debate, and the reason why I came back this time. And there are kind of two main reasons, I suppose. Last time, the topic of the debate was all about the extent to which policing should be trying to take action based on evidence, so clearly a general subject dear to my heart. And I'd never chaired a debate before, so it was a fascinating thing to come and do. It was highly entertaining, and there was a very good spirit in the room, but it was also a fascinating exercise in trying to separate out matter and manner. For those of you who've been reading up on your debating and how debates are actually put together, it's both the content and the way that content is put across, of course, that you're supposed to judge. Now, I found it almost impossible last time to keep up because there were so many jokes. I was kind of getting distracted by the jokes when I should have been paying attention to the content. But, I did okay. So that's what I'll be doing today. I'll be listening to both the matter and the manner of the debate. And this time round, obviously, this is a hugely important topic right now. So that's the other reason for me to come back today. I should be extremely interested to hear what you found in the course of your researching in content terms. You'll all be aware of the National Oversight Group that's currently sitting on domestic abuse. The College is doing a number of pieces of work around reviewing the evidence on risk assessment and the use of risk assessment in domestic abuse. And we're also working with others around new ways of training officers and thinking about what the responses should be to domestic abuse. So for that very serious reason, I'm extremely interested to hear what you found and how you've put that information together. And I'm really looking forward to hearing the debate. So that's me done. And I'm going to now call you all to order, I think. Are you all sitting in order of how you're going to proceed?
The speaker is close to the aisle to save us all time.
So...
We're all happy with how we've set it up.
Right, okay. Yeah, okay. In which case, I'm also going to be quite timing focused in the spirit of fairness. You will only get your 5 minutes. So I'll let you finish a sentence or two, so I won't cut you off completely. But I will be timing each slot, okay? Just to make sure that don't get more than their fair share. Do you want to take a break? Halfway through?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, so after the third speaker on each side, we'll have a pause for people to reflect on what we've heard so far before we continue. And I think that's most of the procedure, isn't it?
You just state their name before the video takes.
Oh, yeah, and when you go to the podium, yeah, you state your name so that it can be used against you. Yeah, sure. That would be great. Okay, so I will now read out the motion. So we have, whereas custodial arrests for common assault against domestic violence generally lack evidence to benefit the victims or community, this House resolves that police discretion to arrest should be the default option in most such cases, and the police profession should launch a new era of innovation and experimentation in policing domestic violence. Make it through to the end. And you are speaking first for promotion.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of my team and I propose the following motion for. In framing our proposition, a useful starting point is to briefly consider the context and development of the current policing approach to domestic abuse. In the UK, the recent HMRC inspection, Everyone's Business, detailed that in 2012-13, there were 270,000 reports of incidents of domestic abuse to the police. The range and extent of such incidents is diverse. The HMIC reported that two-thirds involved some degree of assault. At the most serious end, 2% involved intent to cause serious harm. Yet at the other end, 28% involved no injury at all. Regardless of the presence of injury or not, there will be a victim, and very often children present and directly affected. The potential impact of such incidents cannot be underestimated. Indeed, Wallaby in 2009 estimated the cost to society in the UK to be in the region of £16 billion a year. The history of the policing of domestic abuse has evolved over time. The most significant policy tipping point occurred further to Sherman's 1984 Minneapolis domestic violence experiment, which showed that arrest appeared to work best in reducing the risk of repeat violence. The findings of this research were significant. In the US, UK and a number of other westernised countries, the policing policy and approach changed to one of positive or mandatory arrest strategies. Critically, however, Sherman at the time cautioned that the results of his study should be repeated in different settings, such that the evidence base could be built to inform future policy. So it is that, set against this context, we fast forward 30 years to the University of Cambridge, April 2014. As policing professionals, each of us have arrived with a depth of operational and leadership experience. As a generation, all we have known as being the policing policy of positive or mandatory arrest in cases of domestic abuse. So in framing the case for, it is timely to reflect upon what we have learnt in our first year in Cambridge. Firstly, as Sherman stated in 1998, evidence-based policing is the use of the best available research on the outcomes of police work to implement guidelines and evaluate practice. In Block A, we reflected on the principles enshrined within the medical profession: do no harm. In this block, Peter Nehrud outlined the treatment model to us and the key questions that should be considered when considering policy and practice. Professor Sherman and Sir Dennis O'Connor have reaffirmed to us a one-size-fits-all approach rarely enables us to deal with the complexities of crime. For UK-based officers, we have reflected upon the early development of the College of Policing and one of its aims to establish itself as a world-class professional body which identifies, develops and promotes good practice based upon evidence. So considering the learning in the context of domestic abuse, we return to the evidence that Sherman advanced in the opening chapter of his book, Policing Domestic Violence. Using a medical analogy, he neatly summarises the reality current position. That domestic violence is the single most frequent form of violence that the police encounter, yet the prescribed cure of arrest may be doing more harm than good. That positive arrest is a drug that potentially cures some patients but makes others sicker. A drug that may make the disease less painful amongst working people, but more painful amongst the poor and unemployed. A drug that relieves the pain for a day, but may increase it a year later. And a drug that works for white patients, but not for black women. The evidence supporting these findings, my colleagues will explore shortly, set against a more detailed consideration of the context of policing domestic abuse, the use of discretion, and the views of sovereigns. They will also point to credible alternatives to arrest from research around the world. So in closing, I quote the words of John Maynard Keynes: "When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir?" Well, class of 2014, in opening this debate, I contend that the facts have changed, and the current evidence base is such that as leaders in the future of policing, we have a responsibility to consider the evidence and explore alternative ways of responding to tackling the complex issue of domestic abuse. Accordingly, I ask you to join me in supporting the case for the motion.
Right, good morning.
My name's Mark Tarbitt. I'm a Detective Chief Inspector with Thames Valley Police. And I've listened with interest to the view outlined by my colleague there. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to open the debate for the counter view. I'm extremely privileged to be joined by an international and distinguished collection of policing professionals to support our argument. I will introduce them to you shortly, but I just wanted to take a few moments to frame the narrative of our argument. Policing is on a journey to professionalise. We're developing a knowledge base, we've legislated a code of practice, and we recognise that we need an evidence base to underpin and inform our operational practices. However, we don't believe that this should come at a cost of compromising our ability to protect those most vulnerable people in our communities. The recent HMIC paper into domestic abuse highlights that last year 77 women were murdered in domestic homicides. One in four young people have their childhood blighted by violence and abuse. The police have a responsibility to protect life. The decisions that we make today could have serious ramifications on our ability to continue to do that. The view that we have is that arrest should be the primary option for officers attending domestic incidents rather than discretion. And we don't believe now is the time to innovate and drive research and policy within domestic violence. And there's three key points I want to make in relation to that. Firstly is that there is insufficient clarity of current available research to actually inform the discretion of officers attending domestic incidents. They will not be clear what what works best. They will not be clear around what courses of action are open to them. And this is further compounded by research by Chief Constable Sarah Thornton that says the risk processes we currently use are inadequate, allowing us to predict who those most vulnerable people actually are. And that's why arrest is the best option. We cannot leave this to chance or discretion. And the other point is that policing, particularly operational, is about managing immediate and short-term risk. Yes, there has been some research by Professor Sherman in Milwaukee in which women who have whose partners have been arrested have some long-term, perhaps early death. But this is a long-term risk over decades, you know, 23 years. Policing is about short-term risk. And actually, the causal mechanism that drove that harm cannot be evidenced at this time either. The legitimacy of using the arrest as the best operational tactic is reinforced through current police doctrine and actually the expectations of the partners and agencies that we work with. They also suggest that and are adamant that arrest is the way to deal with domestic risk. And the third point is around innovating. If we start to try and innovate now, there's a risk of knee-jerk policy that's misinformed being pushed out to policing organisations. Evidence-based policing is still embryonic within police organisations. We are, as of the current time, we are still not clear around the limitations of research. There is a time to innovate, but it is not now. The proposals outlined by my colleague, these are radical. The stakes are high here. We're not ready. The time is not now. We need to get better at research. We need to become consistent in the way that we apply research. And then we need to be meticulous in the way that we interpret that research and form policy. There are other arenas that we can do this without the high-risk environment of involving vulnerable people within domestic abuse. Right, there are four key pillars to our argument. Ellie Macbeth, higher analyst with Police Service Northern Ireland, will actually outline to you how the current scientific evidence supports our argument. Superintendent Subhas Ram Kalawan will tell you why our argument is supported by stakeholders. Commander Jeanette Kerr from Northern Territory Australia will tell you why our argument actually sits within the police organisational characteristics. And Special Agent Ben Langle from the FBI will tell you why police leaders should have a slow-thinking approach to safeguarding. And DCI Gwyn Dodds will then conclude and finalise our argument. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'm Gillian Porter from Durham Constabulary. Just to come back to some of my learned colleagues' points, you talked about arrest being the primary option and there being insufficient clarity to inform and predict, or based on the evidence. We'll suggest that that is not true. You talked about how policing should work in this area of responsibility. We will use the Code of Ethics to suggest that we should be brave leaders who take informed risks. So on that point, I'd just like to provide some context. My colleague has already given you many facts about the facts and figures in relation to domestic abuse, but I would just like to remind you we are talking about 3 out of 10 women and 2 out of 10 men almost being victims of domestic abuse from the age of 16. That's thousands of victims every year. The cost to society, again reminding you by Wolby in 2009, is also reported and reinforced by the HMIC as being $16 billion. In the next few minutes, I would like to provide the context or narrative within which we are called to deal with those incidents and help the most vulnerable in our society. The current definition of domestic abuse was set by this government in 2013, and a revision of this definition is out for consultation at this moment. The government has rallied, and I quote, a call to end violence against women and girls in their strategy published in 2010. We don't disagree with this. They have monitored and refreshed their action plan each year and have introduced new strategy guidance for domestic homicides and reviews and new legislation, for example, DVPNs and Clare's Law. The Shadow Cabinet have also stated domestic abuse as a priority with an aim to focus more on the legal system as a whole and prosecution for offenders. In a local context, domestic abuse is a priority in almost every police and crime plan in England and Wales. Domestic abuse is recognised as a serious issue and a priority in many, if not all, of the countries represented here. We support the call and the prioritisation. What is also clear is that police and partners will continue to deal with domestic abuse against a backdrop of significant cuts, which will undoubtedly impact on service to victims and their families. The Equality and Human Rights Commission describe a postcode lottery of support to victims in their 2009 report and show a map of the gaps on their current website. CADA published figures in 2010 to say that for every £1 spent on independent domestic violence advisers and supporting the MARAC process would be a £2.70 saving to the public purse. And yet, these are the very areas that are being cut in recent figures produced by the House of Commons. They report 31% cuts already. HMIC were heavily critical of the police in their report published in March this year, stating that the overall response to domestic abuse is not good enough. That domestic abuse is a priority on paper, but not in practice, and that it is not translating to operational reality. They report alarming and unacceptable weaknesses. However, what HMIC failed to recognise in their report was a focus on successful outcomes, long-term outcomes for victims, and which outputs created these outcomes. They did what many current measurement frameworks do and counted what is easy to count, for example, domestic abuse incidents, compliance with DASH assessments, and arrest rates. The latter is the very thing that my colleagues will later show, if not applied with discretion and a knowledge of the evidence, can cause harm to those we wish to protect. What is clear is that there is a victim and a family behind every case, and it's our responsibility to allow our officers the discretion, based on the evidence, to decide in every circumstance if arresting an offender is the right thing to do. My aim is not to cover the evidence in this section. My colleagues will do that later. However, I do want to address the concerns that may come from those who say this is simply too complicated for frontline officers and what happens if they get it wrong. But the guidelines, advice and support for these officers already exists. The National Decision-Making Model explicitly encourages the use of discretion to help learn from decisions that have successful outcomes as well as this small proportion that do not. The fourth ACPO risk principle clearly states decision makers will receive the support of their organisation in all instances where they can demonstrate that their decisions were assessed and managed reasonably in the circumstances existing at the time. The Code of Ethics states the choices officers make should be based on evidence and best professional judgment. And finally, the ACPOL guidance for domestic abuse, published under authorised professional practice, does state failure to make an arrest when the grounds are there to do so may make a victim at further risk of offences. However, the same guideline states discretion does exist. We call that officers must be allowed to use this discretion for arrest for common assault for domestic abuse, and that NDM, ACPOR and the risk principles and the Code of Ethics provide them with the support to do this. So we would suggest we support the motion.
Good morning, I am Ellie Macbeth, and as Mark mentioned, I'm a police analyst with the Police Service of Northern Ireland. So my view of this situation is fairly different in that I don't have the operational experience. So I am going to present to you the evidence that is outlined and available to make decisions at this stage. Before I do that, I'd just like to pick up on some of the comments from the FOR side. So brave leaders who take informed risks. These are not informed. Our view is the evidence is not sufficient to make those risks informed. Furthermore, there is more than evidence available to make your decisions, and that's how we've structured our argument. The evidence is only part of the picture for making a decision on evidence-based decision-making. Fine, moving on to your comment around the Code of Ethics. Accountability is one of the 9 principles. Mandatory arrest makes it more defensible and accountable. How is it going to be that officers at 3 a.m. in the morning in a volatile situation, do they genuinely have the evidence and tools available to them to make an informed decision? We argue that they don't, and my colleagues will later on pick up on that exact point. So, as I mentioned, I'm going to outline the available evidence that we have. And to quote Professor Sherman, police know far more about the prevention of domestic violence than they do about preventing any other offence. However, we still have a very mixed picture and we don't necessarily know the best way to move forward. Namely, this is to do with the lack of statistically significant, consistent results across a number of studies. And furthermore, there is evidence that actually arrest isn't the problem, it's the follow-up process. What happens after the arrest? That's where we need to be focusing. I'm going to deal with each of these issues in turn. So starting off with lack of consistent evidence. We argue there is a lack of robust and consistent evidence in relation to the effects of arrest on repeat offending and domestic violence cases. There have been a number of studies in the United States kicked off by the Minneapolis study in the early 80s. Early findings were very positive, suggesting that arrest was the best, as we've already heard. And despite caution, there was a knee-jerk reaction to policy, new decisions, mandatory arrests, which quickly spread across the United States and to other parts of the international community. There were replications, 6 other locations, and the results varied across these studies. This is likely due to differences in sample sizes, follow-up periods. What is repeat offending? How do we measure it? Is it victim reports? Is it crime data? Is it subsequent arrests? What exactly is it we're measuring? These studies measured different things over different time periods for different offenders and different sample sizes. Very, very difficult to get any level of consistency across those results. By mid-1991, 3 out of 6 experiments had found evidence of deterrent effects from arrests. The other 3 had found evidence of criminogenic effects, Sherman 1996. These effects seem to vary depending on race and employment status, with arrests backfiring in cities with more unemployed black suspects. We are going to deal with that issue later on in our debate about this idea of a one-size-fits-all policy and the legitimacy implications of taking an approach of different strokes for different folks. So I'm going to leave that at this stage. A later article reviewing the six replication studies by Maxwell and his colleagues in 2001, found that at least in the short term, up to 30 days, and as Mark pointed out in our introduction, a key point for us is about the short and medium term risk, not to say we don't have a role in long term risk, but essentially that's the bit where we can really make a biggest impact. Arrest resulted in a decrease in partner violence in all sites and across five measures of repeat offending, which were based on police recorded information and victim interview data. The results for the victim interview data were statistically significant. We suggest that that's the most important measure, not what our databases tell us, what our victims tell us. Those were the statistically significant results. Arrest worked in the short term. Maxwell and his colleagues conclude that the findings of this research provide systematic evidence supporting the argument that arresting male batterers may, independent of other criminal justice sanctions and individual processes, reduce subsequent intimate partner violence. Again, we have the may word. There is not conclusive evidence. There are always reasons where we have to be cautious. This is why discretion is not a good idea. The long-term follow-up, as has already been mentioned in the Milwaukee study by Sherman and Harris in 2014, found that those victims whose partners were arrested had a higher mortality rate than those who were warned. However, the authors themselves highlight that there may not be a causal link. And my final point is to say, how generalisable are these results? The majority of these studies are from the United States. Are they actually going to represent the people sitting in this room today who represent Trinidad and Tobago, Australia, the UK, America? Can we actually say these studies are sufficient to make decisions for an international community? Thank you.
My name's Kwok. I'm a detective constable from Thames Valley Police. First of all, good morning, everybody. I'd like to just point out my previous speaker mentioning that there is a lack of evidence. I, outside, argue there is evidence, but we can always want more evidence. But the problem we have is that people who hold the views from the other side put up obstacles and barriers to prevent us from getting more evidence. But before I go into the evidence, it is worth highlighting a few important points. In the UK context, what exactly is positive action? Positive for whom? Even the 2014 HMIC report into domestic abuse says, and I quote, "This term is confusing. It means different things to different officers and is open to wide and unhelpful interpretation." ACPOL 2008 guidelines clearly state that it is the duty of police officers to take positive action in domestic abuse cases. In brackets, this includes making an arrest. It does not say arrest in all cases. Yet why does HMIC criticise forces at a lower end of the arrest rates without examining the individual cases to see if not arresting actually had a better impact for these victims? What positive action really means is positive arrest. Bizarwa and Bizarwa 2002 highlighted that the scale of domestic abuse is difficult to quantify, but it is recognised to be a global issue and believed to be chronically underreported. Hammer and Saunders in 1984, as far back as then, and even further, highlighted that women's groups in the UK have carried out their own research into policing domestic violence, and we were heavily criticised even back then for our failures to respond effectively. To this day, we have continued to be criticised by HMIC reports as recently as this month in their domestic abuse report and the Home Office. So let's make one thing clear. Our side is not saying do not arrest. We're saying give officers the discretion to make the professional judgment and what the best solution would be in the long-term interest of the victim based on the individual circumstance. Arrest may be the best option, but it's by no means the only option. This one-size-fits-all approach of arresting in all domestic abuse cases cannot continue if we are to seriously address this sensitive and emotive topic. The evidence for custodial arrest, as my colleagues have mentioned earlier, for common assault against domestic partners, is generally lacking. This pro-arrest policy came about from our groundbreaking piece of research by Sherman and Burke in 1984, where effectiveness of various police response to domestic violence calls were evaluated. It was found that arrests reduced the rate of reoffending by half against the same victim within the following 6 months. Yet, despite the lack of replication and a full understanding of this piece of evidence, police and policymakers were quick to adopt and wrongly accept that it was a panacea for all domestic incidents with little or no regard to all to the victims' views. See the Home Office Circular in 1990. DASH 2003 highlighted that differing views are held as to whether or not arrest is indeed a deterrent, a punishment in itself, or whether it is an intervention that is incomplete unless followed by other actions that address this form of offending, such as offender intervention programs. So I repeat, our view is that arrest is still an option, but is not the only option. The key word here, I point out, is an option, giving the officers the discretion to make the professional judgment in the long-term interest of the victim. In many of our police delivery plans, we talk about DV being a priority. We talk about caring and protecting for the vulnerable. Yet our actions in this area say otherwise. If this means more training is required, train. If it means officers need the tools, then give them the tools. If it means a better risk assessment model, then complete further research. If you want more evidence, then conduct the experiments. The bottom line is this. As a service, we need to stop ticking boxes and put a halt to this short-term mentality. We talk about diversity a lot in the police service, but our actions when it comes to victims of domestic abuse show a lack of empathy and care. Victims of domestic abuse are all different, and we must tailor our response to meet each individual's needs. Research from established charities such as Respect in 2011 found that many women do not want their offenders to be punished. They view the solution is not necessarily introducing their partner to the criminal justice system. Westmarland and others in 2010 noted that victims want outcomes linked to some improvement of their relationship, including enhanced parenting, reduction in or cessation of abuse, and they want their men to understand the impact of their abuse. Frederick and Lidstad's 2003 found that in the US, it was found that alternative to convictions, such as court-mandated intervention programs, were favoured. Women felt safer in such programs where offenders were engaged in trying to change their behaviour. So to conclude, to continue this blanket arrest policy where victims' views and long-term interests are disregarded, I argue, is lazy, ignorant and dangerous. I will now pass you over to Tom, who outlined evidence in a chronological order.
Good evening. My name is Subhash Ramkalavan from Trinidad and Tobago, affectionately called Ramdish by my team. I am now convinced. Having heard the three speakers on the other side, I must say preposterous, totally absurd, as they have launched such an assault on your intelligence with high expectation that your perceptive intuition would lead you your rectitudinal direction, bringing you to their mental state of being totally discombobulated on this issue. I tell this Honorable House, be it resolved that police discretion to arrest should not be the default option in domestic assaults against partners, and police profession should not launch a new era of innovation and experiment at this time in domestic violence. I will address you on stakeholders, values and concerns. The primary stakeholders are the people and groups that are directly affected. Secondary stakeholders are the groups and people indirectly affected. For this purpose, three main stakeholders have been identified: offenders, community victims. I repeat, offenders, community victim. The question here is, what do the stakeholders want? Well, the speaker before me, on my side, answered the question. Arrest! That's what the police are here for. Arrest! We say, yes, offenders of domestic violence should be arrested. And this is supported by the many references made by the speakers on my side earlier. Those studies talked about police support, onward referral for support on injunctions of offenders, and more so on the requirements of the police to protect families, victims, and here is quack, the removal of the victims of violence, advise the victims of support group, such as the Women's Aid. Considering offenders, on arrest, the offender is removed from the scene into the police-controlled environment. Following this, the offender will be afforded access to programs and interventions to prevent reoffending. This is a proven method as shown through Project SCARA and the Milwaukee experiment of potentially taking the sword of Damocles approach through conditional caution, but the prerequisite is arrest. Operational word, arrest. Arrest is also beneficial from the offender's perspective. The arrest of and removal of the offender from the scene of the offense is a sure and safe way of protecting the offender from escalating behaviors which will lead to more serious offenses being committed and greater penal sanctions. The second stakeholder is the community, the general public, that is. They are not interested in spending their taxpayers' money on risky experiments. Your third speaker, came here to tell you about Walby. Well, let me tell you about Walby. According to the Walby study, the money could be better spent on proven police practices and, in particular, prevention. Such prevention include primary prevention, addressing violence before it occurs, with special emphasis on children in the school system. Secondary prevention, working with those at risk, such as pregnant ladies, children, infirm, sick, elderly. And thirdly, tertiary prevention. Who does that fall in? Straight into the bosom of the police. Doesn't it? Intervention for the offenders after violence has taken place to assist the prevention of further reoffending. This will enhance partnership working with the police and other agencies such as probation, local authority, adult services, etc. All working to the same aim of immediate protection of the people at their most vulnerable. Does the community want the police to give different responses to the same offense? I heard you said no. That's right. A consistent response will be positive for police legitimacy. A typical example, for instance, in Trinidad, lower class people being arrested for the said offense, where the upper class people not arrested for the said offense. Is this what you want? Public outcry by members of the public. What I say, arrest first, follow-up action by the police, and this is a fair and consistent response for all. The third and most important stakeholder is the victim. By not arresting the offender, are we sending a message to the victim that we, the police, are trivializing domestic violence perpetrated against them and leaving them at the mercy of the offenders? This is a direct contravention of the guidance provided for by the victims and support agencies such as Women's Aid, and the early intervention projects and guidance provided to the police. The default arrest of the offender takes away burden from the victim of having to choose to initiate processes of domestic violence protection orders or restraining orders. This is intervention after arrest. In most cases, the victims are not in a state of mind in the immediate aftermath to make a constructive decision. Non-arrest will lead to an erosion of the trust, faith, and confidence the victims will have in the police. And in this context, I invite you on the other side to explain the causal link for me between non-arrest of domestic assaults and a positive outcome for stakeholders. Thank you.
Good morning. Tom Hunt-Smith, Metropolitan Police. I'm on the side four. I'm going to talk now about the evidence which has been demonstrated by the against team in a humorous and perhaps a disingenuous tone to date. I'm going to go through some of the studies, starting off with the seminal work Sherman and Beck, 1984, Minneapolis study that promoted the original idea that arrest does have a deterrent effect on recidivism for domestic assault. The research recommended further tests before implementation of this policy. However, US policymakers ignored this caution and made it a mandatory policy. This work has formed the basis for the positive arrest policy that we see here in the UK context today. The subsequent experiments in Milwaukee, Omaha, Charlotte, Colorado Springs falsified the external validity of the Minneapolis experiment, demonstrating that policymakers had indeed been too hasty in implementing the blanket dictate. The best commentary of all of these results come from Sherman in his 1992 book. The results of these studies are complex. They clearly challenge the central premise of mandatory arrest laws that arrest always works best. It is recognised that some studies found that arrest slightly lowered offending rates, but it's not always the best predictor of repeat offending. Numerous studies since the initial and seminal work have further shown the effects of mandatory arrest have different effects on different racial and ethnic groups, as well as persons from a lower socioeconomic background. As our multicultural society continues to strive to be more fair and equal, a policy which discriminates in this manner is at best unhelpful. Further research from Peyton Hamilton in 1992 has shown that arrests lead to different increases in assaults amongst employed and unemployed suspects. The idea of differential justice is supported by Sherman and Smith in 1992, looking at the study tracking the Milwaukee cases of outcomes of arrests from official records and through follow-up interviews with victims. Arrest did have a conformity effect on married and employed men, but this was not representative across the rest of the society. As noted by Paternoster in 1997, the decision to arrest by the police or not arresting the suspect in the case of a spouse assault should in part be affected by the suspect's personal characteristics, their behaviour notwithstanding at the scene. In an era of increased austerity, it's worth taking note of Maxwell's comments in 2001, where he talks about a review of previously mentioned studies today. Recommendation, a programme of rigorous and research involving many studies of time and place, across studies of time and place to inform police accurately. There needs to be a need to assess the benefit and cost of arresting all suspects before you can make a systemic conclusion. We do accept there is an area of huge concern around the DASH risk assessment model studied here at Cambridge by Sarah Thornton in 2011. The results are clear. DASH is not a suitable predictor of harm for DV, and we argue that further experimental work takes case to allow officers to have the right tools at the right time when making these difficult and complex decisions. The folly of this mandatory arrest policy does not end with just unwanted results for the victims. In 2013, Sherman and Harris followed up the Milwaukee study, showing that suspects randomly assigned arrest in the DV cases died from homicide at a consistently higher rate than comparative control groups over the two-decade period. The most recent and perhaps most concerning compelling evidence that discretion is urgently required in this field of criminology is again research from Sherman Harris in 2014, where they found that victims were 64% more likely to have died of natural causes than if parties were arrested and jailed, than warned and allowed to stay at the home. The effect was disproportionately highest amongst African-American victims holding jobs as opposed to white victims. Despite this, policymakers here and around the rest of the world, including the HMRC latest report on domestic abuse, are still blind to the fact that more research is needed and are still focused on this ill-conceived track of a mandatory policy and blanket for all suspects. In the recent report, they go so far as to say that alternative approaches being trialled by some forces, Hampshire and Durham, must stop. As suggested by Sherman in 1992, all of these studies raise serious concerns about the appropriateness of a universally mandated or preferred arrest policy for misdemeanor spouse abuse. Whatever the effects of these findings in determining a causal link, it does provide strong evidence for proposals to further test criminal sanctions in the way that medical treatments are tested before use on patients. We must sincerely look at our actions and understand what has been done. What is the purpose, of police intervention in domestic violence? Is it to address the harm already done at the scene, or is it about preventing long-term harm in a manner which is much more victim-focused? We argue that it is a combination of both and they are not mutually exclusive. We recognise that much of the research mentioned so far has been American-based, which is why it is so vital that the police leaders in this room come together and take an interest in domestic violence and an active role in conducting experiments and launch a new era of innovation. Thank you.
Jeanette Kerr from the Northern Territory Police in Australia. I'll just commence with some rebuttal in relation to some of the points outlined by the affirmative team. Ms Porter outlined that guidelines exist that advise and support officers as long as they make arrests on the best available evidence and the best professional practice. Then Mr Vo said the guidelines are confusing and mean different things to different officers. So, you know, the unstructured and repetitive argument by the affirmative is probably showing greater support for our case. which is based on a model of evidence-based policing. Each of our four speakers are outlining that for you. Mr Hunt-Smith agreed that there needs to be rigorous assessment across all cases before you can make a systematic conclusion. Yes, we absolutely agree with you. And until then, rest as a dominant policy is the most appropriate action to continue with. Unlike the UK affirmative team, we agree with you, Mr. Hunt-Smith. Police leaders, international police leaders in this room, have come together for the negative. And on that basis, I'm representing two arguments in two key areas. Firstly, our organisational capacity impacting on the operational application of discretion in reality. In regards to organisational capacity, there are a range of organisational facts, characteristics and influences that prohibit the free and unfettered use of discretion for officers to determine whether they may arrest, not arrest or take other action. These factors include inadequate training to understand the complex nature of family violence, particularly for our more experienced frontline officers who often confront these situations in high stress and emotion. There's no evidence, despite what was claimed by one of the affirmative speakers, there is no evidence of any instruments, risk assessments or decision-making tools to inform constables in regard to the appropriate and effective use of discretion in responding to domestic violence. And as such, the risk of making poor judgments is significantly increased. There is a history of poor evidence gathering in at least a large number of cases as outlined by the HMIC. This poor practice is a barrier to successful outcomes for the victims and the community. There is general agreement that while there is rhetoric across governments and police agencies regarding the importance and high status of domestic violence policing, this is not actualised operationally. Unfortunately, our organisational cultures dictate that DV response is often viewed as low-status work. There is more kudos to be gained from locking up a burglar than locking up a domestic violence abuser, despite the crime harm being significantly less. Organisational sovereigns that impact significantly on police practice, say arrest, must be the dominant practice in dealing with DV offenders. College of Policing APP says arrest. HMIC says arrest. ACPO says arrest. Governments, including Home Secretaries and Ministers responsible for police and justice, say arrest. Advocates say arrest. The Australian New Zealand Policing Advisory Agency says arrest. Police agencies say arrest. Within our international community, we have universal policy in regards to positive action. The guidance is very, very clear. Victims need arrest. ACPO states, 2008, Failure to make an arrest when there are grounds to do so may leave the victim at risk of further offences. It may also mean the force is vulnerable to legal challenge under the Human Rights Act and law relating to negligence. Until the affirmative can provide rigorous evidence that arresting DV offenders should not be the dominant practice in dealing with DV offenders, then we must work within the best evidence and guidance and advice that we have available, that of the sovereigns already mentioned. The second key point I will address is that of the complexity in applying discretion and the unintended consequences. Police CEOs can issue policy directives, guidelines and instructions in order to effect some administrative control over discretion. These are published in policies that provide guidance on how discretion will be exercised. When discretion is being exercised by a member, it must be exercised with three key tenets in mind. Firstly, in the public interest. Secondly, in alignment with organisational values, and that's the very essence of acting with integrity. All of our values require us to preserve life and keep people safe. And thirdly, under the obligation to protect victims and vulnerable people. Only arresting domestic violence offenders satisfies these key principles of discretion. In exercise of discretion, if used incorrectly, the public, the person involved, the police organisation, the member exercising discretion experience negative impacts. Because there are unclear expectations on police in regard to the complexity of responses, it is clear that arrest as the dominant response policy is essential, not only to protect victims, but the police agencies and the members themselves. Only a strong policy to arrest for DV offending would resolve this dangerous confusion. When our agencies work within a wider political and judicial environment where domestic homicides are subject to review, critique and the application of blame, we have organisations that are risk-averse and officers fearful of making mistakes due to sanction. The only appropriate response is to provide clear direction to our members to protect them and our agencies. In the case of domestic violence, this clear guidance is arrest DV offenders. As I said, the College of Policing APP says arrest. HMIC says arrest. ACPO says arrest. Governments and police ministers say arrest. The Australian New Zealand Policing Advisory Agency says arrest. So on that note, I challenge the affirmative to provide rigorous evidence that arresting DV offenders should not be the dominant practice in dealing with domestic violence offenders. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Rob Chalkley from Dorset Police. The opposition state that innovation is a knee-jerk reaction. I will show that this is not the case. No appropriate risk assessment tool? ACPO doesn't say arrest? Everything I've heard from the opposition supports the motion that the police profession should launch a new era of innovation and experimentation in policing domestic violence. As we've heard, the evidence suggests arrest and exposure to the criminal justice system is not helping victims, offenders and their families. It is clear innovation is required. But a history of innovation already exists. We've already heard about the Minneapolis and Milwaukee experiments led by our very own Professor Sherman. I won't say any more about them other than to say they are examples of an inspirational, pioneering an inspirational pioneering innovator leading a very worthy cause against domestic abuse. This and other examples of early innovation has arguably led to a tipping point in developing and shifting the policing response to domestic abuse. Within the UK, Project CARA, a Hampshire police-led experiment, supervised by our very own Dr. Strang, seeks to explore the role of offender workshops on domestic abuse recidivism, provided by way of conditional cautioning. This initiative has already led to 46% fewer arrests in the treatment group. The victims also highlighted their preference for the offender getting help over arrest, which begs the question whether arrest only is truly victim-focused. Although in its early days, it's an example of current and very promising innovation. Within Europe, excellent examples exist, including Utveg, The Way Out, a Swedish initiative between police and key agencies focused on cognitive behaviour therapy for low-level DV offenders and support for victims and family members. A significant drop in reoffending is an important outcome. Further afield, the effects of second responder initiatives have been explored. The College of Policing have undertaken a review based on the 2008 Campbell Collaboration systematic review on the same issue. Face-to-face follow-up visits within 2 weeks can make victims slightly more willing to report subsequent domestic abuse. Although it did not find evidence of the project's changing offender behaviour, it highlights just how important it is to take the time to explore and research all innovative ideas. A global impact in innovation is being felt. The Queensland Police have developed a bespoke domestic abuse strategy, at the heart of which are closer partnership working, enhanced training for officers, vital to ethics-centred decision-making by frontline officers, research and development helping to shape proactive and preventative strategies, innovation at the forefront of their approach. The movement of domestic abuse innovation has led to key collaborations, including the Daphne European Union funding programme, which seeks to contribute to protecting children, young people and women against all forms of violence. This collaboration is clearly stimulating innovation and research and is open to all. Three key national bodies responsible for shaping the working practices in UK policing have given a clear direction for forces to innovate, providing top cover to do so. The HMIC new inspection paper on core business recommends crime prevention training to all officers. Domestic abuse is a crime, and the systematic evaluation of our tactics to ensure how effective they are. The College of Policing strategic intent highlights their role in promoting good evidence-based practice. They are, in their words, a catalyst for the development and use of knowledge and research by and for those working in policing. Knowledge that is accessible for practitioners when making hard and difficult decisions. We've already heard from Rachel about the College's current focus on domestic abuse risk assessment and essential training to empower staff. ACPO outlined their view for arrests in their 2008 Domestic Abuse Manual, which clearly states the decision whether to arrest or not a suspect rests with the police officer, not yet mandatory. Launch a new era of innovation? Is it already here? We can see many examples where ideas are explored and good practices spread, key to which is essential training for our staff to ensure well thought through ethical decision making. Our job is to embrace this with an arms open wide approach. Have we reached a tipping point? This room is full of innovators and early adopters, all of us. That's why we're here. We all have the match, and the forest is dry. We've heard this week about Malcolm Gladwell and the need for connectors, mavens, and salesmen, all key to driving change. Do you know who these are in your organisations? Because you will need them. We've also heard about Gladwell's Law of the Few. We are the few. Yeah. We happy few. Yeah. We band of brothers. Let's get innovating.
I'm Benjamin Langle from the FBI. Good morning, Professor Sherman, our distinguished guests from the College of Policing, faculty and staff, and fellow students. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'd like to begin with 2 points of rebuttal. During his introduction, Paul Mills, Chief Superintendent with Wiltshire Police, stated that the reasons for domestic violence are numerous and diverse. Completely agree with that. Believe that to be true. But if that is the case, then how do we expect officers who are at a residence at 3 a.m. to make an informed decision when the facts are often hidden from them by both the offender and the victim? And I also like to rebut a point that my friend Rob Chalkley, inspector with the Dorset Police, made. He said, it's time to usher in a new era of research. Neither he nor any of the previous speakers have mentioned how this is going to be paid for. Where is this money going to come from? Are we going to raise taxes? Are we going to take money from other social programs, from education? No one has made mention of where the money for this new era of research is going to come from. So I would like to take a few moments to discuss the managerial position against the suggested radical change in domestic violence policy. The fundamental role of the police is to protect and preserve life. In most situations, police should arrest batterers. We are not suggesting that officer judgment and discretion in exceptional circumstances be taken away. We are, however, arguing that the default position should be towards arresting the offender. We fear that, for reasons I will discuss, not arresting batterers could lead to an erosion of confidence in the police. Several of my colleagues have spoken about scientific evidence or lack thereof towards the opponent's suggestion, and they've also provided stakeholders' views towards this policy. I would like to discuss some significant fiscal implications around the implementation of the policy suggested by opponents. As everyone in this room knows, that policing as an occupational field does not have a great history of implementation of new policies. We're not ready for such a sea change of policy at this time. Our opponents argue for discretion towards arrest in domestic abuse situations, but in the same breath argue for more research. Are they hedging their bets in case their position is wrong? And as I said before, where will the funding for this research come from? A randomized control trial could easily cost £500,000. Who's going to pay for this? No mention of this has been made. In times of constrained budgets and austerity, such studies are not economically feasible, they're not financially responsible. And to make such a change of not arresting offenders without absolute certainty that we will be protecting victims is not the right thing to do. As Detective Chief Inspector Mark Tarbett suggested during his opening, our desire to professionalize should not come at the expense of vulnerable members of society. I would also like to speak of the effectiveness of discretion. Is this a good idea? Is it fair to expect young, inexperienced police officers or police constables to sort out a domestic violence situation at a residence where an offense has occurred, sort it out, and decide whether or not to make an arrest? L. Macbeth mentioned officers responding at 3 a.m. We have two 25-year-old officers at a residence 3 in the morning, and you expect them to make a decision with the limited information that they have at hand. Police constables, police officers are not psychologists, they're not social workers, they're not counselors. Policing has a much wider function than just responding to domestic violence. How much training and education is it going to take to get police officers, police constables to the point where they can go respond to a situation and make appropriate decisions? Having a default position of making arrests in cases of domestic abuse is a very simple algorithm. If there's probable cause to make an arrest is made. It's very simple. Remove the offender from the situation, allow the prosecutor, domestic violence counselors, social service agencies to sort it out over the next few days using type 2 thinking once the offender has been removed from that situation. Kahneman tells us that algorithms beat clinical decisions. So we've talked about some implementation problems related to both funding and training of young officers about this issue of discretion. Let's talk about some concerns related to police legitimacy. Fundamentally, it's an issue of fairness. Who is going to be arrested and who is not going to be arrested? Let's say that this policy is enacted next week. 1 year from now, 18 months from now, 2 years from now, patterns emerge that certain ethnic groups are arrested at a higher rate than others. Will there be public outcry? How is this going to affect police legitimacy? Once again, policing will be in the unenviable position of having to defend ourselves against charges of bias. This could lead to lack of confidence in the police amongst the public, and especially amongst certain groups. Look at the current controversy surrounding stop and search in the United Kingdom and the controversy surrounding stop and frisk in the United States. Are we ready to add a third controversy to policing? In addition to this loss of confidence, there's a cost of failing to act by not arresting a batterer? What if police respond to a situation at 3 a.m. and they make a decision not to arrest the batterer, and the victim is subsequently murdered by the spouse or their domestic partner? Everyone in this room has heard of anecdotes of this happening. They'll be terribly tragic for the victim, be devastating to his or her family and friends, but it would also be devastating to the constables that responded to that call. They would have to live with that decision for the rest of their life. Furthermore, it would be very damaging to the agency that employs those officers. It would tarnish their reputation, and it would tarnish the reputation of policing as a whole, and policing would suffer a diminished reputation. The police have a responsibility to protect victims, and they failed. So this lack of positive action in protecting a vulnerable victim would lead to a lack of confidence in the police. Arrests are not the problem. We realize that we cannot arrest our way out of domestic violence. The problem lies with the follow-up. It's the dropped cases, the lack of prosecution, the lack of intervention by social service agencies. If a domestic situation deteriorates to the point where the police are called, clearly some sort of intervention is needed. By arresting the offender and removing him or her from the situation, it slows things down and allows the police, the prosecutors, domestic violence counselors, social service agencies to utilize the type 2 thinking and develop and implement an intervention plan tailored to that specific offender and victim and their unique circumstances based on algorithms. We're not saying that the offender should not receive diversion or restorative justice. Those are separate issues. What we're saying is the default position should be towards positive police action and arresting the offender. In conclusion, a default position to arrest an incident of domestic abuse is manifestly fair. It protects police legitimacy through a transparent policy. It provides young officers with a simple, easy-to-understand algorithm, and it protects vulnerable victims from further victimization. The police must show the public that we are not biased, that we provide equal protection under the law, and that we as a police are worthy of the trust and confidence of the public. This suggested change in policy is not the right thing for the United Kingdom, it's not the right thing for Australia, it's not the right thing for Trinidad, and it's not the right thing for the United States. So in closing, I would like to ask the next speaker a very simple question. It's incredibly important, and I look forward to their answer. And the question is this. Where is the research around trust and confidence in domestic violence victims that tells us what the impact of changing the policy on arrest will be? Thank you.
Good morning, colleagues. I'm Darren Henstock. I'm from the West Midlands, but if this goes wrong, I'm from Devon and Cornwall. It's always great when the FBI makes your case for you, I find. I'll answer your question, Ben. We haven't got the evidence, but neither have you, so let's innovate, shall we? How about that?
Yeah.
Okay, let's not forget what the question was. Police discretion to arrest should be the default option in most cases, and the police profession should launch a new era of innovation and experimentation in policing domestic violence. The last speaker probably answered those arguments in the affirmative. I don't think they've made that case, and I'll just tell you why. We've had a lot of evidence that arrest is not always the best option. Professor Sherman, Dosh, Peyton Hamilton, the list is long. The DV costs the taxpayer nearly £16 billion, according to the HMRC. And it accounts for nearly 20% of police calls. There isn't even a figure for the attrition after arrest of a DV case. Most offenders, we know, are out after 6 or 7 hours, back to the family, and with no support mechanism in place. But people's lives can't be mentioned, mentioned with money. We aim to be a professional body with the college at our head. And the college has set out a code of ethics as a step towards this. Officers in the Code of Ethics are told to treat people fairly and make choices based on evidence and professional judgment, i.e. discretion. And they define discretion for us, which is helpful to cops. Use your training, skills and knowledge about police to consider what you're trying to achieve and the potential side effects of your decision. We'll go back to Peel. Our role's not apprehension. It's the pursuit of crime prevention. Discretion is a common thread running through his principles. Dr. Tankavy in this very room told us about self-legitimacy, which our FBI colleagues are probably qualified to talk about. But it's greatly affected by effectiveness. A blanket policy, when a professional knows it's the wrong thing to do, damages your self-legitimacy. And by consequence, the legitimacy of the organisation in the public eye. We all have got anecdotal evidence of the such as that from Chief Constable Mike Barton last week. But not only is the evidence that it doesn't work, but we've got physical harm is being caused to victims and offenders. If we go back to our medicinal allegory that we're trying to compare ourselves to, if that pill cured someone but made others sick, if it made the disease more painful in the poor and unemployed but less painful in working people, if it released pain for, or relieved pain for a day but increased it a year later, or if it works for white patients, not black women, would the medical profession use it? So why do we? Doctors are trusted to use their skill, experience and training to accurately diagnose and treat disease. We want to be professionals. The alarmists are saying this is a proposal of non-arrest. No, it's not. It's a proposal to use professional discretion. That's all we're saying. Arrest. That may be the appropriate option at 3 a.m. in the morning when you've haven't got the full facts. But in a lot of cases, it's probably not. But we need support from the top level to be confident to do this as constables on the ground. The ACPO risk principles have been mentioned, and I'll quote them to you. Harm can never be totally prevented. Risk should be judged by the quality of the decision-making, not the outcome. To reduce risk aversion and improve decision-making, policing needs a culture that learns from successes as well as failure. And members of the police service who make decisions consistent with these principles should receive the encouragement, approval and support of the organisation. We haven't got that from commanders yet. Maybe our distinguished guest from Northern Territories will tell us why our commanders don't support us in that way. We've heard of innovation and with studies that are currently ongoing, Project CARA, DV workshops, UDFAG, cognitive behaviour therapy, second responder initiatives in Canada, the Queensland DV strategy, training officers. They're all out there. We are innovating already. And let's return to the College of Policing again. The guidance in the Code of Ethics given to chief officers. Seems not many have read it. Show moral courage to do the right thing, even in the face of criticism. Be flexible and willing to change the course if necessary. Create and maintain an environment where you encourage and monitor feedback. So there is opportunity to innovate and seek evidence-based solutions to difficult problems. Colleagues, the time is right. Budgets are slashed. Groups of agencies need to come together. And there is evidence out there for different solutions. DV policy has been examined in great detail, but we know there are different ways of reading the evidence. We need to be confident that we don't go towards what happened with Professor Sherman's experiment or the much maligned 35 calls for service or 35 incidents of domestic violence before there was a call for service. Let's look at the evidence, innovate properly. Let's do the research. Should we work with our academic institutions? Let's train our officers properly. And it will be expensive. Of course it will be expensive. But we're spending $16.7 billion on a policy that doesn't work. But also, let's look at the cost of ignorance. That's our current DV policy and the argument that our opponents have here. Thank you.
Good morning. My name, amongst other things, is Gwyn Dodd. I'm coming from a public protection, domestic violence background. I'm astonished, as I'm sure you are here, to find myself in the position of having to oppose the type of policy that led to over 1,400 vulnerable girls being subjected to sexual abuse over an extended period in Rotherham. The type of policy I'm talking about is one of discretion and inaction. However, we are where we are. You have heard from a number of speakers from England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, Trinidad, Australia, and the USA, male and female, black and white, who are all experienced police professionals. They've all provided you with a compelling argument as to why the default position when attending domestic violence should be to arrest, and why the current focus of research should not be on domestic violence. You will have noticed that the argument followed Peter Neyrud's model for making evidence-based decisions. He was put forward by the proposer as an expert. You have heard, in relation to the best evidence available for domestic violence, that the initial results in the USA were inconclusive, cannot be generalised, and have been unable to show a causal link. On this topic, Tom was careful to only mention that they falsified external validity. Rob wasted time by skimming over them and clumsily ingratiating himself to the very intelligent Professor Sherman. And then continues to use gender-specific terms such as sir and brothers. I will leave you to decide whether such prejudice is appropriate to guide policy. Sorry, Rob. In relation to the stakeholders, whether Women's Aid or the Early Intervention Foundation, you're almost deafened by their pleas to arrest suspects and take decisions away from survivors when they are particularly vulnerable. The default position of arrest also provides safeguarding, gateways for support to reduce reoffending, and a consistency of approach. When the organisational characteristics were presented, you heard that the police do not have the training or risk assessment tools for the effective use of discretion. The proposers seem confused over this. On one hand, they encouraged informed and managed risks, but subsequent speakers conceded that the tools to guide such decisions simply don't exist. You're then almost drowned in a tsunami of organisations who have responsibility for inspecting and directing police forces, including HMIC, ACPO, the Australian and New Zealand Policing Advisory Agency, and both the Home Secretary and Shadow Home Secretary, who is advised by Peter Neyrud, put forward by the proposers and experts. Calling out for a more robust approach from the police in relation to arresting suspects for domestic violence. Ben emphasised the police's first priority is to protect and preserve life. He argued under the theme of managerial experience and judgment that the poor use of discretion leads to bias and prejudice in police officers. Kwok argued that positive action as a concept is unhelpful and confusing. Can you imagine the chaos of discretion with no guidance other than do what your discretion tells you? Ben continued that a typical randomised control trial might cost £500,000. This is the equivalent of 22,000 officer hours. When you consider the confusion and uncertainty that the American studies produced, it becomes a lonely place to argue that money should be spent on more trials as opposed to more police officers to investigate domestic violence. research into police tactics should be focused on other areas. I would like to conclude by thanking you all for listening to our argument today and leave you all with the following thoughts. Despite being asked on each occasion, the well-researched and informed proposers have failed to produce the evidence which shows a causal link. Indeed, the evidence is ambiguous at best. Instead, they rambled on about causing harm and commented on compared highly trained doctors against PCs. However, for completeness, let's imagine the scenario that we do follow the evidence. We would end up only arresting white employed males. Legal, ethical, and moral barriers would quite properly prevent us from doing this. So, for all those vulnerable victims who are unable to make the right decisions themselves, I urge the judges to do the right thing. Thank you. Thank you.